With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the CDFA is seeking some help in defining regenerative agriculture. And global wine production is down, so is consumption. More on both of those, but first, our top story today. U.S. dairy organizations, along with elected officials and ag leaders, are expressing disappointment over Friday's decision by the USMCA dispute panel in a challenge against Canada's dairy trade quotas. The U.S. charged that the quotas don't line up with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Last year, a USMCA panel ruled with the U.S. However, Executive Vice President for Policy Development and Strategy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council, Jaime Castaneda, says that case did not solve the problem.
The problem was that the first case didn't go far enough to basically argue that Canada had to actually truly open their market and allow for a number of different players in Canada to be able to actually input, like retailers, food distributors, restaurants, pizza chains, and so on.
He says those users should have automatically been included, but since they were not specifically named, Canada excluded them, and that's what the U.S. challenged this year. Castaneda says despite this year's decision going to Canada, there may be other steps the U.S. can take.
Well, there is a number of different options, and I would say that I'm not in the position right now, because it would be something that would require a lot of conversations with the U.S. government and lawyers and so on, so, and members of Congress to determine what the next steps are. But I can assure you that as soon as actually we know something, we can share with you and your audience. But we're going to be talking closely with the government.
What are some of the thoughts of farm and food commodity organizations and trade groups about USDA's recently announced Regional Agricultural Promotion Program? Rod Bain looks into it.
The public now has opportunity to provide opinions on USDA's recently announced Regional Agricultural Promotion Program. As announced by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in mid-November.
We're publishing regulations in terms of how that program will work. We're opening up a 30-day comment period.
That Federal Register public comment period concluding on December 18th. Among those expected to offer comment, various agricultural trade organizations and commodity groups. What are some of their thoughts about RAP?
What it does is it allows us to keep up the pressure in terms of our marketing effort.
That view from Steve Mercer of U.S. Wheat Associates. One of the reasons for the interest in RAP is the timeliness of its announcement. USDA's Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, created in 2018 and operated by the Foreign Agricultural Service, is set to expire in 2024.
We were looking at a bit of a cliff. ATP is ending in June, so that extra funding is going to be gone. So it allows us to continue that work to do more and more work promoting U.S. wheat around the world.
Joe Sheely of the U.S. Meat Export Federation, meanwhile, says he sees the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program serving in a similar capacity as ATP in regard to exploring new export markets and being more aggressive marketing and promotion-wise in emerging markets.
We have export promotions in a lot of established markets, and not just promoting meat, but with opening up new doors and building relationships with importers, with distributors, with retail meat buyers, food service meat buyers. Some extra revenue really goes a long way when we're able to dive into especially some of the emerging markets.
Also, like the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, RAP is designed to serve as a complement to existing U.S. Farm Bill Ag Trade programs, such as the Market Access Program and Foreign Market Development Program. That is recognized by those in the export realm, such as Brent Boydston of the U.S. Grains Council.
What we've seen over the last several years, MAP and FMD funding, is as we've gone on in years, inflation and depreciation have brought that down, the value of it. So with USDA investing this money into the cooperator groups, I think you're going to see it put to use in these foreign markets developing them.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
In this week's Almond Matters, brought to you by Valent USA, growers are gearing up for what is projected to be another wet winter. Here's Brian German.
In this week's Almond Matters segment, we've got Todd Berchtold here with us again this morning. He's a field market development specialist with Valent USA. And today we're finishing up our conversation here on pre-emergent programs and what growers are going to want to keep front of mind. And now, Todd, making comparisons to last year, it was a bit atypical, being that we got a tremendous amount of rainfall. And with a forecasted wet winter ahead of us, what kinds of impacts might growers expect when it comes to weed pressures?
Typically, our winter annuals come up. Fleabane marestail are starting to germinate right now and push through. You know, there's a little bit of rain, but any moisture right now will, you know, cause germination. And so getting the products on before you have germination of the weeds is pre-emergent, before they come up. Otherwise, you got to put a burn down with it, which is, you know, there's always going to be some that come through earlier than later. Weeds don't always emerge at one time. If they did, it'd be a lot easier, but they don't. So you typically have to put some type of burn down with them. Roundup, you know, has been historically the product of choice. And after the leaves are off the trees, there's no worry about getting uptake onto the trees themselves. You know, you're spraying dormant during the dormant period. So that's a good time to mix your burn down with your pre-emergent program.
And again, with last year's weather, did it seem like there was quite a bit more weed pressures based on maybe a lack of action or maybe an inability of action there? What might be a good timeline this year with a little bit of moisture already, but quite a bit more expected overall?
You know, getting it on last year was problematic because of the weather. If you can't get into the field and you've got moisture, you know, you get weed germination. People couldn't get in to get the applications on, so consequently weeds came up, and then you're dealing with bigger, tougher weeds to kill with your burn down products. The later you can go is actually advantageous if you're only going to go a single application of pre-emergent, because the longer you wait to put it on, the longer it's going to last into the spring. But like I said, the best treatments we saw last year was Chateau full rate of 12 ounces with Matrix, Chateau Prowl, and then Chateau with a reduced rate of Allium that performed really, really well out to, in one case, I had trials out that were 190 days out and still clean. So, but they were put on in the end of December, and like a day or two later, they got significant rainfall upwards of a half an inch. So that incorporation really locked them in there. You've got to get them into the soil where they were, they're going to work in the upper layer of soil, basically creating a chemical blanket.
And so part of that would be, you know, maybe getting a forecasted plan out there, maybe using materials that you could come in a pinch later on in the season towards spring for a follow-up application.
Correct. Yeah. It's always, you know, it's good to have your materials lined out and what you're going to do and get them in the barn. So, you know, you're not scrambling, you know, you wait till the last minute and then there's product shortages or a distributor might have product. So it's always better to, you know, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and have that old adage stays true to this too, is having product available to put out when you need to put it out. When the window's there, you need to apply it.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. In today's National Spotlight, the USDA's final 2023 look at the winter wheat crop has some encouraging news. Here's Gary Crawford.
Some encouraging news in USDA's final weekly report on the winter wheat crop. Emergence is ahead of normal, for one thing, and the condition of the crop continues to improve. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says first on emergence.
91% of the crop that will be harvested next year has emerged. That is 2 points ahead of the five-year average of 89%, 1 point ahead of last year's 90%.
And as for the condition rating of this crop as it prepares for its long winter's nap?
50% good to excellent and 15% very poor to poor.
So basically a 4% improvement in just this last week. And these condition numbers, they are the best we've seen at this time since 2019. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey gives us a look at the condition ratings for the winter wheat crop.
And so as we finish up with the reporting for the crop that's now heading into dormancy in the northern areas, 50% good to excellent and 15% very poor to poor. Those are the best conditions we have seen since the autumn of 2019. And that is a 2-point improvement in the good to excellent categories from a week ago. That's a 2-point improvement in the very poor to poor ratings from a week ago. And compared to a year ago, where we had a much more expansively drought-affected crop, rated just 34% good to excellent and 26% very poor to poor.
He also has an update on wheat emergence.
91% of the crop that will be harvested next year has emerged. That is 2 points ahead of the five-year average of 89%, 1 point ahead of last year's 90%. We do see emergence 100% complete in 4 of our 18 reporting states. And then the only state that's a little behind on the emergence progress is California, 40% emerged, 5-year average, 47%. All other states either very close to, equal to, or ahead of their 5-year averages for emergence.
And Ribby gives us a final report on the cotton harvest.
We have our final look at least the final national look at the cotton harvest progress. As of November 26th, 83% of the cotton harvested. That is 4 percentage points ahead of the 5-year average, but right on par with what we saw at this time in 2022. Now we have 3 of our 15 reporting states completely done with harvest, all 3 in the drought-affected Mississippi Delta. Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi completely done with cotton harvest. On the flip side, we've been watching all along as the late maturing California crop finally started to catch up a little bit with harvest, but only at 80% harvested on November 26th in California. 5-year average there is 91%.
As for the corn crop, Rippey says some states still have a lot to harvest.
And then if you're looking for states with still appreciable acreage left to harvest, well, we see 3 in the Midwest, and we'll start off with Michigan, where corn harvest is 79% complete, 5-year average 83%. Next up, we have Wisconsin, 85% harvested, but that is on par with the 5-year average. And then third, we have Ohio at 86% harvested, 3 points behind the 5-year average.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's livestock report. Thanks, Randall. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
More than $3 billion is being made available through the Emergency Relief Program 2022 to assist with financial losses from crop yield and value reductions related to disasters. President and CEO of the Almond Alliance, Aubrey Betancourt, is encouraging industry members to learn more about the assistance that's being made available.
ERP for 2022 hard freeze has finally been released. So this is pertaining to the hard freezes from early 2022, really knocked out, especially young trees. That had a huge effect on last year. That program, ERP through FSA, has been released finally, 9 months later. The Alliance actually went after Secretary Vilsack because it just was taking far too long to get that out. So farmers need to reach out to your FSA office if you were in a county that got hit or contiguous to a county that got hit in that hard freeze of 2022. Reach out. You should also be getting stuff in the mail. And another thing to keep in mind, and this actually came out of our grower committee recently, is when you get that ERP phase one, don't forget to do ERP. ERP phase two. You're leaving a lot of money on the table if you're not taking advantage of that. A lot of stipulations still in place around whole farm revenue, of course, and you need to qualify. But it's easier for them to say no to you than for you to never try. So don't leave it out there on the table. Watch out for that ERP for 2022 disaster. Call your local FSA office if you have any questions.
Climate Robotics has won the 2023 Ag Sharks Pitch Competition, securing a $250,000 equity investment from Judges, Western Growers, and S2G Ventures. The company specializes in mobile biochar production systems for commercial agriculture. Applied to agricultural soils, biochar enhances crop yield as well as water and nutrient retention, potentially sequestering up to 2 billion tons of atmospheric CO2 a year. Climate Robotics trailer-mounted systems enable cost-effective on-farm production of high-value biochar. In addition to the investment, the company will receive international recognition, mentoring, potential access to farm acreage for technology piloting, and exposure to Western growers' extensive network. Other finalists in the competition included Cultiva, presenting plant cuticle health technology, and Provision, offering compliance simplification for growers. As the 2023 growing season concludes, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service will conduct nationwide surveys to compile year-end crop production data. These surveys form the basis for official USDA estimates of production, harvested acres, and year-end supplies for major U.S. agricultural commodities. Survey responses critical for calculating county yields must be submitted by November 29th. The collected data aims to aid farmers and processors in making informed year-end decisions and planning for the upcoming growing and marketing season. NAS plans to release the analyzed survey information in reports including the Crop Production Annual Summary and Quarterly Grain Stocks reports on January 12, 2024. The reports will be accessible online at nas.usda.gov/publications. Global wine production for the year is expected to be at its lowest level in about 40 years. President of Allied Grape Growers, Jeff Bitter, said it's probably a good thing overall that production is down, but it really only follows the lacking demand in the global market.
So we might be in a position where we're producing as little as we have, and I think it's almost four decades now in terms of global production. But the reality is, in terms of the world, we just don't drink as much wine as we used to, particularly in other countries that used to be very heavy wine consumption countries, mostly in the EU. They are not consuming at nearly the rates that they used to, you know, a few decades back. So it does help us, obviously, that world production is down, but, you know, California is only about 10% of the world's wine production to begin with. So we're just kind of a small fish in a large ocean of wine, so to speak.
Input is being sought on how California should define regenerative agriculture and how it relates to state programs. The California Department of Food and Agriculture, in collaboration with the State Board, is organizing the first of five public listening sessions on December 6th via Zoom. The goal is to establish a clear definition of regenerative agriculture for state policies and programs. The initiative aims to incorporate science-based standards into agricultural policies, providing a comprehensive framework for farming methods that enhance natural resources across California. The suggested framework includes criteria such as applicability to California agriculture, positive impacts on environmental, social, and economic goals, measurable outcomes, and emphasis on soil health. Details about the public listening sessions and the process for defining regenerative agriculture are available at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. A pilot program involving USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service and the U.S. Agency for International Development is providing Tanzanian youth an opportunity to apply learned geomapping skills to agriculture and, in turn, potential opportunities in ag-based careers. Rod Bain looks at this pilot involving the organization Youth Mappers in this edition of Agriculture USA.
An international network of university students across the globe help address local and global development needs through their training and skills as mappers. So what happens when a Tanzanian chapter joins forces with the U.S. Agriculture Department's Foreign Agricultural Service in a pilot program that addresses data collection needs within agriculture?
A group of us traveled to Arusha, Tanzania, and that's where we conducted a training of trainers workshop, helping to introduce them to the agricultural sector.
I've been very impressed with the level of interest that we've seen from within the department and from our collaborating partners in continuing this program and making it not just a pilot, but scale it up.
I'm Rod Bain. Lisa Colson and Luke Nye of USDA FAS join us as they discuss a recent collaboration with Youth Mappers in this edition of Agriculture USA. Crop data, whether it's weather, crop condition, crop model information, or any number of agricultural statistics, these data resources are useful and in many cases can stand alone. That's according to Lisa Colson, a geographer with USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. Yet,
that information is only as valuable as what the degree to which we understand where the crops are grown, when they are planted, and when they are harvested.
Translation, eyes on the ground. field enumerators, and assessors that can see crop conditions firsthand and coordinate that information with satellite imagery.
So sometimes we know, broadly speaking, cotton is grown in a specific region of a country. That country might be Tanzania. But during a severe drought, has the farmer decided to switch and grow a different crop that year to try to minimize using water-intensive crop like cotton in their production?
FAS staff contribute to field observation and data used in USDA information sets, such as the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Although Colson acknowledges, in some cases, there's time limitations for staff. Recently,
we were approached by USAID, the International Agency for Development, asking us if there is some sort of agricultural project we could do with this group called Youth Mappers. And we immediately thought of this challenge we have, that we need that ground truth data. We need that direct observation of where a crop is being grown during different time periods of the season.
Colson mentioned the African nation of Tanzania earlier, as it was the location of a pilot program involving 14 youth mappers, university students in Tanzania, that are part of a global network of chapters participating in mapping activities in response to local and global development needs. Yet, as Lisa Colson explains,
usually youth mappers are mapping features from the built environment. They're looking at roads, homes, stores. They want to know what those buildings are and where they are. So having them identify agricultural fields is a bit different for them. But we saw this as an excellent opportunity for empowering these tech-savvy young leaders in Africa to expand their understanding of geospatial work.
These students gathered various data on grain, oilseed, and cotton crops in over 300 fields in the Arusha area of the country, with such information including photographs, georeferencing, and identification of target crops. As the Foreign Agricultural Service's Luke Nye explains,
this pilot project is a great example of how FAS can work with local partners as well as with U.S. universities to be able to put together this program and to use an existing technology, existing infrastructure, and existing network, and to be able to tweak it for agricultural purposes.
After the initial pilot in April, participating youth mappers spent time later in the spring training Tanzanian youth on geomapping and other logistics associated with obtaining on-ground crop and field data. Nye says the success of the pilot in Tanzania could lead to a scale-up of the Youth Mappers in Agriculture project.
Both within Tanzania or within the region of East Africa or the East Africa community, or even more broadly across the continent or into other places around the world.
Especially as Youth Mappers serves as an opening as a career path into agriculture.
One of the challenges worldwide is that youth are not going into agriculture. It's a problem in this country. It's a problem around the world. And so engaging youth with technology and with new ways of doing things and showing that agriculture is not just with a hoe in the field, but rather is a much broader opportunity, has been something that we think is a positive draw.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
How much more than last year will shoppers end up paying for food this year? The USDA has a new forecast. Gary Crawford has the story.
For food shoppers, the last couple of years have been tough on the wallet and have put the squeeze, yes, on many people's budgets. It was like we were on this food price roller coaster that was only going up and at a very steep angle, too. Historically, retail food prices do go up every year, but by an average of about 2%. But in 2022, we saw prices at the grocery store shoot up an average of almost 11.5%, caused by COVID and the war in Ukraine and bird flu outbreaks in our nation's poultry flocks and other supply chain problems. So then comes 2023, and Agriculture Department economists were only a bit more optimistic about the situation when they made their forecast for 23 at the start of this year.
In January 2023, our forecast for food at home prices in 2023 was for 8% growth.
Better, but still very high. However, USDA economist Megan Schweitzer says that 8% food price inflation forecast is happily turning out to be overly pessimistic. Food price hikes have not been as high as expected.
So now we've made our way down. Our latest forecast is for 5.2% growth in food at home prices in 2023.
And the news on this is even better than it appears. Now, yes, the average price increase for all of this year is projected to be up by 5.2%, but hear this.
So far in 2023, we've seen prices for food at home for groceries rise 5% already through the year. And our forecast is for 5.2%. So most of the price increases we're expecting in the year, we've already seen happen.
And so we shouldn't see much in the way of significant price hikes for the rest of this year. And Megan said most of those increases came in the first part of 2023. So when we add up those monthly price increases and average them out for the whole year, there are food products that are averaging quite a bit higher than in 2022.
So some of the categories where we do continue to see and forecast larger price increases in 2023.
Increases from 7 up to 9%.
Are for fats and oils, for sugar and sweets, for cereals and bakery products and processed fruits and vegetables, and for non-alcoholic beverages.
And on the flip side of that,
we expect to see a small decline in pork prices in 2023 by 0.4%. And in addition to that decline in pork prices, there are a few categories where we expect less than 1% price growth in 2023 for fish, for eggs, and for fresh fruits and vegetables.
And if you just compare prices now to the same month in 2022, there are some foods selling for less than at this same point of time 1 year ago, including eggs, fish and seafood, dairy, and fresh vegetables. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's interview segment.
Matt Youngman, National Events Director for Farm Progress.
And we're here out at the Organic Grower Summit. It's going to be 2 days of quite a bit of information. And so let's just kind of start here with what people can expect out here.
Yeah, it's a great two-day event, as you mentioned. And the days are similar where, you know, this morning it kicks off with education all morning and then a trade show in the evening, closing out with a real fun reception with some cool toys and tech gadgets to play with out at the opening reception. And then again tomorrow, another half day of education, which is capped with the Grower of the Year presentation. And then again in the afternoon, more fun at the trade show, capped with a happy hour.
And with quite a bit of education and sessions over a couple of days, I mean, what are some of the topics that are being addressed here, and what's kind of maybe the target audience for people that might learn some new things here?
Yeah, so anybody who has any part of the organic industry would find this of interest. And, you know, the education is everything from how's AI going to impact this right down to seed purity and standards from the government and you know, all those kind of things, packaging and just kind of a broad spectrum education platform for anybody who's in that organic industry.
And one thing that is seems like it's built out a little bit more this year are some of the outside things to kind of show and tell. That seems to be a pretty important aspect of something like this, of, okay, you can hear about it in these sessions, but now you can go see how some of these things work.
Well, yeah, it's important to have an event like this right here in the Salad Bowl, you know, right next to the Salinas Valley where all of this production occurs. And so we're getting to a point where we've kind of maxed out the Hyatt. We've added some new booths in some new places, but yeah, taking it outside and actually being able to bring in tractors and technology and those pieces of machinery and allow the growers to go out and interact with them and see them in person, get hands-on with them is a little bit of something that we love to see that at the events that we do in other places, the ability for the growers to physically interact and you know, you learn by doing. And so to put your hands on it, literally kick the tires and kind of take it all in.
And now, with something like this, I mean, there's a lot of growing interest. It's an event that we've been to in years past, but from your perspective, does it seem like maybe there's some more interest in behind the entire organic sector there?
Yeah, it seems to be growing. I mean, with the sold-out trade show floor and the expanded trade show floor, there's a lot of appetite from the exhibitor side and from the education side. And so, you know, we're just the conduit to try to make those handshakes occur between these growers that are coming in from the region and from around the country that want to learn more about this industry, whether they're deep in it or they're just kind of starting to dip their toe into the industry. It's a great place for either side of that to learn.
And it seems like with some of the panelists that are on deck for this. I mean, you've got growers, you've got some people that are involved in regulation. It seems like a pretty well-rounded perspective that people can hear out here.
Yeah, and it's not just sit and be forced to take it in. You know, you have choices. There are multiple things going on at the same time. So if you're really interested in seed and you don't want to know so much about packaging, there's kind of different tracks that you can go down on the education front. And like you say, Matt Seeley and this group at OPN have done a great job of putting together the who's who of who can speak and take you through the journey of this organic process.
And lastly, just for people that are hearing this, there's still opportunity to come down and register on site. I mean, where are we, and how late can people register to show up for this?
Yeah, you can register just as soon as you park your car. Just pull in here to the Hyatt. You know, we're here in Monterey at the Hyatt, and you can it goes all day today and then all day tomorrow. There's a Thursday only registration, so you're not too late to come and join. And you know, you can find out a lot more at organicgrowersummit.com.
Thank you, Brian. And we have another interview for you now from my recent visit at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention. Start out with your name and title, please.
My name is Andy Folta. I'm the U.S. Product Marketing Manager for Climate Field View with Bayer Crop Science.
Tell me a little bit about your digital solutions for ag.
Right. So Climate Field View is our digital platform, and it's essentially a one-stop shop landing page hub for farmers to be able to collect, visualize, and analyze data. So they can bring in any kind of, you know, data layer as they go over their fields. Every time a farmer drives across their acres, they're generating data. A lot of them have been generating and collecting it for years and decades in some cases. FieldView gives them a place to put it so they can visualize it, pull reports, do trial analysis on it, but then also take that data and share it either to a third-party platform to utilize it in, you know, new and exciting ways, or, like we've seen with the majority of our Climate FieldView users in the U.S., take it and share it to a trusted advisor, so an agronomist or a dealer, so they can help them dig out insights on their acres.
So the sharing aspect of this, it seems that that would be very important, because it's one thing to have data, it's another thing to make sure the right people have data.
Right, and like I've said, we've seen the majority of our farmers take that data and they share it because, you know, farming is very hard. It's very taxing on farmers, and they're not making these decisions in a silo. A lot of times they're building a network around them of, you know, farm managers, agronomists, maybe some industry representatives. So we give them the option to take the data at whatever level they want. They can share a single field, specific parts of the data, or their entire operation, and they can share it to that trusted advisor so they can start to, you know, A, dig through the data and discover some insights, but also they can start to build some plans for the, you know, future year. So we have tools and capabilities for farmers and dealers where they can go in and create variable rate planting prescriptions, essentially a crop plan for next year. And then we can execute that in the cab with our connections with Precision Planting, John Deere, and all of our OEM manufacturers, so that as a dealer, I create my plan with a farmer, it syncs over to the piece of equipment, and it gets put into the acres.
So for our listeners who are hearing this and thinking, wow, this would be amazing, what should they do to get more information?
Okay, so I would do one of two things. So we have climate.com, great domain. On there we have all of our information about what the platform is, what it can offer for all of our crops, not just corn and soy, but also cotton, silage, specialty crops, you know, potatoes, tomatoes. I would also look in climate.com at our knowledge center. So support.climate.com walks through everything from creating an account all the way through generating a prescription and executing it. We also have a really dedicated field staff team of climate enablement managers. We've got about 40 across the country. So you can find their contact information, and they're really good at that boots on the ground on farm support.
Anything else our listeners should know, or do you think that covers it?
I think that covers it, but you can check out our socials and also our podcast Around the Farm to learn about all things digital ag.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Wrapping up our news this morning, we return to our top story. U.S. dairy organizations, along with elected officials and ag leaders, are expressing disappointment over Friday's decision by the USMCA dispute panel in a challenge against Canada's dairy trade quotas. The U.S. charged that the quotas don't line up with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Last year, a USMCA panel ruled with the U.S. However, Executive Vice President for Policy Development and Strategy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council, Jaime Castaneda, says that case did not solve the problem.
The problem was that the first case didn't go far enough to basically argue that Canada had to actually truly open their market and allow for a number of different players in Canada to be able to actually input, like retailers, food distributors, restaurants, pizza chains, and so on.
He says those users should have automatically been included, but since they were not specifically named, Canada excluded them, and that's what the U.S. challenged this year. Castaneda says despite this year's decision going to Canada, there may be other steps the U.S. can take.
Well, there is a number of different options, and I would say that I'm not in the position right now, because it would be something that would require a lot of conversations with the U.S. government and lawyers and so on, so, and members of Congress to determine what the next steps are. But I can assure you that as soon as actually we know something, we can share with you and your audience. But we're going to be talking closely with the government.
The White House this week held the inaugural meeting of its Council on Supply Chain Resilience with participants including the Agriculture Secretary. Rod Bain reports.
We're coming together to ask a simple question. What's next? What can we do? What must we do to keep making progress, to keep our supply chain stable and secure in the long term?
Among the solutions offered by President Joe Biden Monday,
the launch of a new Council on Supply Chain Resilience. I'm charging this group to ensure that our supply chains remain secure, diversified, resilient.
With the inaugural meeting of this council conducted Monday as well.
I'm also directing my cabinet to create an early warning system that uses data to spot supply chain risks to our economic security, our national security, our energy security, and our climate security.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack attended the meeting as a member of the White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience. USDA investments in supply chain resiliency in the past 3 years include almost $200 million in 185 projects nationwide. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
An Illinois jury found that several of the country's major egg producers conspired to limit America's supply of eggs in order to raise prices, in a case that began in a federal lawsuit 12 years ago. Several large food manufacturing companies in the lawsuit filed in 2011 said producers used various means to limit the U.S. domestic supply of eggs to increase the price of eggs and egg products during the 2000s. Brandon Fox, an attorney for the food manufacturers, says, quote, "We are incredibly pleased that the jury held egg producers Cal-Maine Foods and Rose Acre Farms accountable alongside United Egg Producers and United States Egg Marketers for conspiring to inflate the price of eggs." Damages will be decided during a trial this week. The jury found the egg suppliers exported eggs to reduce the overall supply in the domestic market and limited the number of chickens available for laying eggs. Greg Hardin, a best-selling author and former Associate Athletic Director of Student Counseling at the University of Michigan, will be the keynote speaker at the 2024 Farm Bureau Convention. He'll address attendees during the closing session of the annual convention on Monday, January 22nd. Hardin counseled more than 400 student-athletes, including names like Super Bowl champion Tom Brady, Heisman Trophy winners Desmond Howard and Charles Woodson, and Olympic swimming champion Michael Phelps. Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval says persistent, patient, and resilient are among the traits that professional athletes share with farmers and ranchers. That's why Greg's message about coaching and mentorship is so timely. The 105th AFBF Convention is in Salt Lake City, Utah, January 19th through the 24th of 2024. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you so much for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.